You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2003, the New York Times Sunday Magazine profiled a group of women who had chosen to leave their high-paying, successful careers in favor of full-time lives as stay-at-home moms in what was called the opt-out revolution. Now, 10 years later, New York Times contributing writer Judith Warner has revisited these women as they attempt to rejoin the workforce in a changed economic landscape. Her article, The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In, was the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. I'm very pleased that it brings Judith Warner back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Was the opt-out generation 10 years ago all that different from women who left their jobs became stay-at-home moms and then later also perhaps wanted to get back into the workforce? Why is this group special?
Do you mean why is this group now special or
yes.
10 years ago special?
I mean, could we have had a similar conversation in the year 2003 about women who had opted out 10 years previous to that?
The interesting thing is that we didn't have the conversation because the Census Bureau numbers didn't exist. What was remarkable 10 years ago was that for the first time, you had a blip in Census Bureau numbers. You had an increase in the number of mothers who were staying home with their children, who were leaving the workforce and staying home with their children. You had had, you know, until that point, a steady increase really since the 1960s and the percentages of mothers who were in the workforce. You had this reversal, and it was not an enormous reversal for the first time at that point, and it was much remarked upon. There are a couple of things just I want to say about that from the start. You know, generation is a big word. We're talking about a small demographic. It was a small demographic 10 years ago. It's a small demographic today. And the larger group of women who always drove those numbers, in fact, were poor women. Poor women with low levels of education, often Latinas. We in the media have forever focused on the women at the upper end of the income spectrum with a lot of education. Just to be clear who we're talking about, that isn't to say they're not important, but still, it's important that we define the terms.
You've written two books on family issues, one about medication, and in the other, Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety, you trace the evolution of the concept of motherhood. Have notions about motherhood changed in the United States over the last decade?
I think they have, by necessity, having been pushed by... It is impossible now.
I think we're having a bit of a problem with our phone connection. Judith Warner is talking to us from Paris. And an interesting aspect of her story is that she had her first child in Paris and perhaps brought that child up in a very different kind of cultural environment than what mothers in this country might be bringing their children up in. Are you back, Judith? Okay, well, before we get Judith Warner back, we were planning to invite our listeners to join in the conversation because we are sure that many of you out there have either experienced this yourself or witnessed it in one way or another, perhaps as the child or the spouse of someone who chose to opt out and then wanted back in. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Judith, welcome back.
I am so sorry about that.
Well, you know, we often have perfect phone connections to people in Kazakhstan, in all sorts of places where you wouldn't expect it. And here you are talking to us from Paris, where we would have thought it would have been perfect. So we were talking about changes in notions about motherhood changing in the United States over the last decade. And perhaps I was wondering how that would be seen in light of the general public's perception of motherhood over the past 100 years or so.
Well, I think we've consistently seen that economic change drives behavior change, which then drives attitude change as people seek justification for what they're doing anyway. It becomes the right thing to do. So, you know, we've seen those kinds of ups and downs over the decades in response to economic change, in response to what was going on with men and men's jobs. And I think we've seen some of that change in this last period. I also think that we've had a kind of cultural backlash against the all mommy all the time kind of motherhood, mode of motherhood that was upheld as the ideal in the late 1990s and early 2000s. We've had almost a decade now of books pushing back, of experts pushing back against hyperparenting, against, you know, a form of motherhood that creates a so-called nation of wimps, et cetera. We even have social science research that's now looking into the negative effects of sort of too assiduous mothering as opposed to the negative effects of daycare, which is what we had in the decades preceding. So I do think that we have a changed climate.
And then, of course, we have this recession, and because of financial constraints, it's not an option in many families for one parent not to work.
Absolutely, and it never was an option in the vast, vast majority of families. But even in families that could conceivably have afforded it 10 years ago when the economy was, or a little more than 10 years ago when this began and the economy was strong in the late 1990s and the tech boom and this whole movement began. You know, these people are, by and large, having a harder time now than was the case. And I also think that people are generally shaken. So even if they still have enough money, there's a general sense of precarity, a sense that you can't just blindly trust that things will be fine in the future anymore. Also, when you're looking at this particular group of women, their children are older. I mean, this is something that happened at a particular point of time to a particular group of women. Their kids are older now. They're not needed around the house as much to the same extent. So they're kind of returning them to themselves and asking themselves, what do I do with the rest of my life?
Now, I mentioned while we lost you that you were living in France when you became a mother. Should I assume that the role of a mother varies widely throughout the world?
Yes, I think you can. And I think, I mean, what's always been most interesting to me personally is looking at the intersection of the way social structures are set up, social supports are set up, and the way people think about and talk about motherhood. That is what had struck me most strongly in coming back to the U.S. from France, where families are so strongly supported, and coming back to our example, where we're basically not supported at all, and how that then plays out both in people's day-to-day lives as they live them and also psychologically.
In this article, you focus on a number of women who left their high-paying jobs 10 years ago to raise their children full-time and are now trying to re-enter the workforce. Did the Times ask you to do a follow-up to Lisa Belkin's 2003 piece, or is this something that grew out of your own writing in the field?
It came out of my own work, my own writing. As you know, I had written a book that was published in 2005 called Perfect Madness that looked at the women who were trying hardest to fit the motherhood ideal of the late 90s and early 2000s, which is the period in which I was talking to them. And I had really become curious over the years, in recent years, to know what had happened to these women, how they were doing 10 years later, whether the recession had affected them, whether the whole change in motherhood had sort of seeped into their consciousness. And just knowing, I mean, these are my contemporaries, that they'd gotten older, and so by necessity their lives had changed. And I was very curious to know what had happened to them. I'd become very interested just in the whole sort of issue of midlife, sort of, you know, thinking out from my own personal situation as these ideas often begin. And I had gone to a motherhood conference in Toronto where I had heard the sociologist Pamela Stone speak about new research that she was doing, updating research that she had done 10 years earlier for her own book, Opting Out, which she had actually begun before Lisa Belkin's article on this phenomenon had run in the New York Times Magazine, but she had given it the title that it had after because it had become such a sort of used phrase in public discussion of it. And that kind of made the idea come together at that point. And the New York Times Magazine, of course, was a natural venue for it since the Times Magazine had coined the phrase in the first place all those years earlier.
Now, I'm talking with Judith Warner, whose article, The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In, was in last Sunday's New York Times magazine. You write that this spring, Lisa Belkin also reached out to the subjects in her article. Many of them seemed to be a little reluctant to talk about what had happened. Did you do the same thing with the women you'd written about in Perfect Madness?
I did, and I reached out specifically to the ones who Margaret called were stay-at-home mothers at the time. And I had a similar experience to Lisa in that, first of all, it was a long time ago. It's difficult to reach people after a certain number of years. But also that a lot of women, even if I did have contact information for them, didn't respond. And in my case, I know it isn't because they disliked the public exposure the first time around, because I didn't use anyone's name in the book. I think that, and Pamela Stone saw an interesting phenomenon with her research, which is that she heard almost uniquely positive stories. I mean, 80%, let's say, greatly positive stories. People who haven't had a good time of it tend not to want to talk. So, you know, it raises the issue of what's behind that silence, what's behind that reluctance. It was somewhat frustrating, but at the same time, interesting in retrospect to think about.
Did they say that they felt it might hurt their careers, their current careers or job searches, if people knew that they'd been out of the work for so long?
Some of the women I spoke with, not the Perfect Madness women, because, again, those whom I was actually able to contact, who responded to me, did speak to me. But other women who I spoke with for the article who had gotten back into the workforce, some of them did not want to be identified by name because they had gotten back in relatively recently and they really didn't want a lot of attention brought to bear on their years out. Yes, because they felt that it would make them appear less valuable, less with it, that it would just make their position now within their companies more fragile.
We have a caller from Long Island. Claire, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just tuned in after getting out of court, and I read the article on Sunday, and of course, you know, my ears perked up about it. I spoke briefly with someone who answered the phone about my experience and a very good friend of mine's experience, how different they were. We're both attorneys, and she opted out, and I did not. And the interesting thing is we both have, you know, some really, you know, really strong regrets about our choices, and I read these articles, and I'm always amazed that at least my conclusion is that women are still struggling with the same issue, which is there just aren't enough options for us in terms of how we can have a family life and a professional life, and it's unfortunate. My dear friend is very bright. She made that decision, and today, you know, she's having a lot of struggles. She'd like to return to work. Her husband has had a downturn in his business. She could use the revenue, but she's struggling with what to do. And I think she's even experiencing what a lot of people feel is that it's a lack of self-confidence to get back out there.
But you also mentioned that you had some regrets.
Well, I do too, because my regret is on the other end of the equation, and that is I did not drop out, and my children are now older, and I would love to have, you know, turned back the clock and have spent more time with them.
Judith?
So, yeah.
I couldn't agree with Claire more in what she said. What this story shows us is that there aren't enough options, that women are facing these sort of draconian all-or-nothing options. You're either in and you're working around the clock, and you're tethered to your whatever device, you know, in the evenings and on weekends, and you're under enormous pressure, but you're in, or you're out altogether. We have so few options in this country for being able to work, let's say, part-time, but still be able to advance, let's say, have health insurance, have proportional benefits, be paid in a way that's really commensurate with what you're doing, because going into a part-time track so often really means being put into a kind of ghetto of not very good jobs. So we have to get out of these kind of black or white, all or nothing options and give both women and men, because I think especially when you look to younger generations, you see a lot more kind of equal expectations and desires in terms of how life is going to be set up, so that people can live differently. And this is both a political change that has to happen, and it's also just a cultural and social change that has to happen.
But isn't it also very difficult to return to a career which is now considered mid-career that you left earlier? There are other people who've been in it all along and have established a long track record. That particularly affects people in the arts.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that at least the stories that I heard really varied according to the kinds of fields that women were in. And also, and it's sort of sad to have to bring these things down to these terms, but it happens to be the truth, how much money they had and what sorts of social connections they had. The women who were the best off and who had the most powerful social connections, so who were sort of the elite, let's say, who were able to spend their time out doing the kind of strategic volunteering that put them on an easy path back in, were in a really good position, especially if they didn't really have any financial pressure on them. Because if they could afford to go back to jobs that paid considerably less than they were earning before and have family-friendly hours, so they were thrilled, they were great, often it was interesting work, they were really well situated. But if they really needed to make money because their husbands, let's say, had lost their jobs, or were earning considerably less post-recession, or because they'd gotten divorced, then they seriously were in trouble.
I got to go to a break, but I wonder, Claire, have you watched The Good Wife?
You know, I have a few times. I have. I can't say that I really followed it. I think it's a great show, great quality production, and, you know, I can identify a lot.
But it's about a woman who returns to a law practice after many years of being a stay-at-home mom.
Right,
she's kind of forced to.
Right, exactly. She's a great role model. But again, I think what the author is saying is some of this has to do with where you are economically as well. I think this is a really important point, and that is women, when they're home for a long period of time, they can become what some people have called institutionalized even, because they're cut off from a social network in many ways, and that creates a whole other set of problems in terms of being confident enough to go back out there.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back to that thought, because a lot of people leave a job, and when they come back, the job has changed completely. Technology, all sorts of other things have changed the way business is conducted, making it all that more difficult for them to get back into the job market. My guest is Judith Warner. Her article, The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In, was in this last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll be back with more right after this. We are back with Judith Warner, whose article, The Opt-Out Generation Wants Back In, was the cover story of the Sunday Times New York Times Magazine this past Sunday. And we are taking calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Judith, you mentioned a number of reasons women want to go back into the workforce. Their children have become old enough for them to be able to. They need more income because of the recession, divorce. But what about feeling unfulfilled?
You know, it's interesting. That was really not a reason that women mentioned to me. I think at least in one case, and I think this is more broadly true as well, I think their husbands felt somewhat unfulfilled, somewhat intellectually unfulfilled when, you know, they married women who were their intellectual equals, both professionals, both having sort of lives out in the world and interesting, you know, things to talk about in common, let's say. And then, you know, in this one case, the wife became very involved in school volunteering, and this became her sort of chief topic of conversation, which was not too exciting for her husband. And she had the sense that he would not have minded if she had an activity outside of their home and outside of the world of sort of school and other volunteers, so that he could be able to hear about something else. So I think, you know, it's kind of funny that it played out in that way. I mean, the reaction of the husbands is a really interesting thing, and something that I hope to be able to explore more in the future. I think that, you know, the women, there were many downsides to opting out, and the large story can't leave that side out of it because it's important. It's important for younger women to know. But at the same time, being with their children was extremely rewarding, and a lot of these women did very ambitious volunteering along the way, and that volunteering was very, very important to them, actually greatly affected then how they came to think about work and what they wanted when they went back to work.
And we are grateful to a number of women who went through that experience and worked on our show when they decided to get themselves re-involved in the world when their children got a little older. We have an interesting call here from a man, Neil from Plainfield, New Jersey. You opted out, Neil?
Well, yes. In the early 90s, I didn't really opt out initially by my choice. I'm an interior architect, and in the early 90s, there was a lot of wholesale slaughter in the architectural world in New York City, and I was one of the victims. And rather than knowing what the situation was at that time, prospects of a job at that time were very slim, I decided to stay at home with my two kids. And I did work part-time. I got assorted small jobs from local, furniture dealerships, office furniture dealerships.
But I'm curious about your experience as a stay-at-home father. Do you think that it was analogous to what women have experienced?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. So I stayed in the field part-time, but not really, because I was working for an entirely different set of people than the Manhattan, New York City architectural scene.
Yeah, I'm trying to push you along here, Neil.
By the time I came back to work, I experienced the same thing that women experience.
Uh-huh.
Which is, I didn't have any of the connections in the city anymore. I was no longer involved in that activity. And at this point in time, in fact, if I were to go looking for a job in the city now, they'd laugh at me because most of the people that they're hiring now for the position that I would be capable of doing and they're hiring at younger levels and younger people at lower price.
So, Judith, this sounds pretty much the same sort of thing that women go through.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
That's my point.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, too, to me in Neil's story is that it's, again, that issue that I raised at the beginning. You know, there's economic change that drives behavior change. And then there's the story that we tell about the change. You know, you did have these men in the early 90s in that recession leaving the workforce and actually being home with their kids. But we didn't talk about an opt-out generation of dads because we didn't turn it into a story that way, right?
But the story that we heard then was men who had been forced out of the workforce and then were forced to rely on their wives as the person who was going to bring home the bacon.
And we talk about that as, you know, as something terrible as opposed to a lovely domestic choice, as we talked about it, let's say, then 10 years later for women. So it's interesting, and we do need to explore those experiences more and talk about them differently.
We're going to take some more calls. Our next caller is Sarah from Brooklyn. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment, I guess it's very related in terms of the pressures and lack of societal support and, in my case, somewhat familial support. But I work in the arts. I was also trained as an architect, and I kind of opted out of having kids altogether because it really wasn't an option. You know, I couldn't work in a kind of a lower-paying field of the arts and figure out how to do it. So it's very related, but not exactly. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. Basically what you're saying is that people have to make choices, and some people chose not to opt out because they realized that it would ruin their careers. Did people you spoke to, Judith, talk about that?
For this article, I was speaking with mothers. But one thing that has really struck me in the past couple of years in talking to younger women is the fact that they are thinking in terms of these stark choices. You know, my generation had, I don't know, the virtue of or the fortunate ability to be clueless. We just didn't think about this at all. You know, we didn't look down the line and think, well, what's the future going to bring? Are we going to have to make choices? We just figured we could do everything. We could do it all. We'd just work it out. And what I hear young women saying now is that they look ahead and they think, I'm either going to have this career or I'm going to have kids. They don't see a way to work out the two. And that's, frankly, for me, I think that's just tragic. And I think that these stories really have to make us stop and think hard about the kind of society we've allowed ourselves to develop into being, where women are facing these all-or-nothing choices, pretty much as they did back in the 1950s, where if a woman was going to be a so-called career woman, she pretty much knew she wasn't going to be a mother. Maybe she'd be married, maybe she wouldn't, but she almost definitely wasn't going to be a mother. That's ridiculous. You know, it's an unnecessary situation. Women in other societies like ours don't face these choices, and we don't have to accept this and live with it.
Anne from Beacon has written in. She asks, as a divorced single parent who has done pretty much everything possible, what is one to do? She didn't have the kind of career of the people that you've written about in your article.
The situation for women who are not at the sort of economic top of the heap is so much harder. You know, as I think I said earlier, the big group that really pushed those Census Bureau numbers showing more women staying at home were poor women, and they were staying home because they couldn't afford childcare. So they had even fewer options. You know, we talk about this as a choice for the wealthy, but it was an utter lack of choice for these women. And women who were working class, women who were middle class, women even who are at the lower end of the upper middle class, they have so few choices because they're just really trying to get by and doing the best that they can. And that's where the need for legislation comes in. That's where the need for social protections, for working hours for those at the lower end of the income spectrum who are having their hours just changed at the last minute, who don't have a guaranteed number of hours, who can't make stable childcare arrangements because they can't predict their schedules in advance. They need protections. Everyone needs the ability to be able to take time off, to be with their kids, to go to the doctor, to go to a parent-teacher conference. You know, people who are upper middle class, who have white-collar jobs, forget that there are 40 million people who don't have the right to a single paid sick day, who can't take their kids to the doctor. It's insane. And that's the point at which we absolutely need to fight for legislative change.
Jessica from Deerfield, Connecticut notes that many women have no choice. They have to work. She feels that the stories of those women are neglected in the when we talk about this. We talk about white-collar, more privileged women usually.
We do. I mean, we in the media have an endless fascination with these better-off women, partly because they're the women we went to school with and live among. And I think that those of us in the media have a very kind of mixed relationship to these women, a combination of identification and envy, so we come back to them over and over again. And I think that as a population overall, we tend to be fascinated with them in a very, very more than ambivalent way. I mean, there's a lot of resentment toward these women. But as a group, they're important for a couple of reasons. One is that, as Lisa Belkin put it back in her piece 10 years ago, these were the women who were supposed to take over the world, or at least their half of it, and they didn't. And a lot of them opted out, or at least slowed greatly down. And so when we have the conversations about why don't we have more female CEOs, why don't we have more female law partners, et cetera, this is a big part of the reason why. And when we think about change, too, on behalf of other women, you know, a lot of these women left because they wanted to be connected to their families, because they wanted to build a certain kind of home. Well, you know, most people want those things, men or women. These women were in a position where they conceivably, had they had a way to stick it out, could have risen high enough where they would have had enough power to bring change within organizations. And, you know, as Pamela Stone, the sociologist, said in my article, when they leave, they close the door behind them and everything stays the same. We need these women to stay in and become powerful so that they can make things better for women who have less power and have fewer choices.
Now, Judith, we have very little time left, but we've been talking about class. What about race? You spoke to African-American women as well. I'm assuming they face other problems on top of having opted out.
They face additional problems in all these different realms that we've talked about. But I would just say, in terms of motherhood, stay-at-home motherhood, I was so thrilled to have met Quay, actually, at the same motherhood conference where I met Pamela Stone. For Perfect Madness, I had talked to a number of African-American women who were part of the organization that she has headed up for the past few years, Mocha Moms, which is a volunteer organization for stay-at-home mothers of color.
Well, and she had been a producer for NBC News, so she wasn't she wasn't in a very bad job. And then she quit to be a stay-at-home mom?
After she had her second child, and that story was added to by the fact that her own mother had just died. And I saw this with a number of the women I spoke with. When they have a major loss, that time with their children became all the more important. But what was interesting there, as an African-American woman, she was told, you know, she had friends and family who said to her, how can you leave? You need to stay in and show the flag and be there for everyone else. And she said, well, no, I need to be able to give my children the same advantages that the white upper middle class mothers in my community can. And also, she feels very strongly that she wanted to be a part of trying to change the cultural narrative about who are African-American stay-at-home mothers. You know, that they're not, as she'll put it, you know, quote-unquote welfare queens, that these are mothers like white upper-middle-class stay-at-home mothers who just want to give their children every advantage.
Judith, we have just 1 minute left, but when I was a kid, I went to nursery school while my mother worked. Child care seems to be less available today than it was even then.
I don't know if that's true. I think if you look statistically, a pretty small number of children were going to nursery school, even as late as the 1960s. There is the availability. The issue remains cost. Child care in many places is more expensive than a year of state university. The cost for good care, for really good quality care, is prohibitive for so many people. And that's another problem we're going to have to tackle.
The opt-out generation wants back in was the cover story in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. My great thanks to Judith Warner for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much, Leonard.